trying to maintain some amount of productivity with all this uncertainty. And, you know, this just amps it up that much farther.
Federal workers in Alaska get ready for a government shutdown. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, April 7th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Stryker Brigade soldiers in Fairbanks prepare to deploy to Afghanistan.
I'm pretty excited to be able to learn of another culture I haven't really learned anything about yet and have a chance to help people.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
the Association of Alaska School Boards. AASB believes that all students should be proficient in reading, writing, and math by the time they finish the third grade. More information at aasb.org.
And by
Full Circle. Full Circle grows, picks, and delivers fresh, certified organic produce year-round. More information about their 400-acre farm and their organic partners at fullcircle.com.
With only one more day to fund the government and head off a federal shutdown, Congress is still wrangling over politics and dollars. The Republicans leading the House and the Democrats in the Senate can't agree on a bottom line. If the government does shut down, 800,000 federal workers nationwide, including an estimated 17,000 Alaskans, won't be able to go to work. Democratic Senator Mark Begich says a shutdown is looking more and more likely with every passing hour.
You know, we're down to just hours, maybe a day from now, and I think it's getting, you know, fairly likely that we'll shut down at this point.
Begich places blame squarely on Tea Party Republicans in the House. He says they're being inflexible in negotiations. Republicans have not named a dollar amount they'd be happy with, but they are listing some deal breakers. They want money withheld from Planned Parenthood and from enforcing environmental regulations. Senator Lisa Murkowski says she won't assign blame to one party or body. But like Begich, she's chastising those who are being rigid and refusing to compromise. And she says it does not make sense to completely eliminate funding for programs like some Tea Party Republicans want.
Well, I'm trying to be reasonable about it. And when folks kind of come into the room and before anybody's even laid out a position, they say, well, I'm not even going to consider it if we're going to be talking about abortion or public broadcasting or drawing these lines in the sand and saying, no, not even going to talk about it.
Murkowski says she's most concerned that a shutdown will hurt military families. She's working on a bill that would allow military pay to go forward, even if a shutdown happens. Agencies are struggling now to figure out which employees are essential and would stay on the job and which would have to stay home during a shutdown. While the fishing industry is federally regulated, vessels should be able to continue on with their seasons. But some National Marine Fisheries Service operations could be affected. Krista Malone Lonnie is a biologist with the agency, and she says that the Unalaska office would close in the event of a shutdown that would make it harder for people to get up-to-date information about the local fisheries. Instead, they would have to call the Alaska Regional Office to have their questions answered.
We'll still have a in-season manager for fishing in the Juneau office, because we have to leave at least one person in place to manage the fisheries. So it shouldn't affect any of the fisheries.
Denali National Park spokeswoman Chris Pfister says the federal shutdown would mean closing national parks across the country.
And what it means here in Denali is that we will close, you know, depending on when and if we get direction from Washington, we'll be closing the park to public access, which will include closing the park road somewhere between its junction with the park's highway. We're not closing the park's highway that goes through a portion of the park and park headquarters. And the facilities that we have open this time of year, which are limited, will close, which will include the Muri Science and Learning Center that we use for our winter visitor center. And we do have a loop of the Riley Creek campground that we keep open. I suspect that there's probably not anyone in the campground at this time of the year.
Pfister says they've identified about a dozen essential staff out of around 100 permanent positions that would stay on to protect park assets and take care of the park sled dogs. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service would also be mostly shut down in Alaska, agency spokesman Bruce Woods.
There'd be a very few people working. I think we'd be reduced to a skeleton staff to what's basically essential personnel. So I think refuge law enforcement people would be available. available to provide public protection and protection for the resource, and there would be minimal people here at the regional office. But I think there will be one person on staff in each refuge.
Wood says the agency has a handful of biologists in the field right now. They would be immediately recalled to Anchorage. At the USGS office in Anchorage, biologist Scott Hatch is preparing to head to Middleton Island in the Gulf of Alaska tomorrow for seabird research. He says it would be very disruptive if he has to fly back immediately.
That would be expensive. You've heard speculation about what it costs to shut the government down. It happens in a multitude of little ways. I mean, if I get out to the island and have to come back in, that's, you know, $1,800 or something to have a plane come out and get me until you get the situation resolved. And then I've spent another $1,800 to get back out and do what I was trying to do in the first place. So what's that, $3,600? My budget can't handle that kind of thing, really. So we just try to do our work and whistle by the graveyard.
USGS biologist Lane Adams just got back from fieldwork on musk oxen in northwestern Alaska. He says he feels fortunate he isn't planning to head back out on a project right away, but he says the whole thing is frustrating.
I mean, it's a hugely wasteful thing to do, and it's late in the fiscal year. You know, we're halfway through. It's, you know, we've been trying to maintain some amount of productivity with all this uncertainty, and you know, this just amps it up that much farther.
An official at the Anchorage National Weather Service office says they will remain open during a shutdown. The West Coast and Alaska Tsunami Warning Center in Palmer would keep on some emergency staff. Two shift workers would remain on duty at all times. The Alaska Volcano Observatory also says it would keep a small staff in the office. The Fort Wainwright-based Stryker Brigade is deploying to Afghanistan. A ceremony was held on post yesterday to formally begin the month-long process of flying the 4,200-member combat team into southern Afghanistan for the year-long mission. KUAC's Dan Bross reports.
Stryker Brigade soldiers sang their theme song as thousands gathered inside a hangar to officially signal the transition from Fort Wainwright to the harsh and dangerous deserts and mountains of Afghanistan. Soldiers stood at attention, some carrying flags that were rolled up and encased in sleeves, symbolic of the upcoming year-long stint away from home. U.S. Army Alaska Commander Major General Raymond Palumbo says the Stryker's mission is a continuation of the national one that began after the September 11th attacks.
There's a lot to the explanation of why America hasn't been attacked for nearly a decade now. A big part of that explanation is the continued commitment of our country to pursue those who wish to do us harm before they hit us again. And that's exactly what our military has been doing for the last 10 years in Afghanistan and elsewhere. And that's exactly what the 1st Stryker Brigade combat team will continue to do.
The Stryker's mission is to fight back the Taliban, train Afghan security forces, and support communities as part of a plan to transition out of the country in coming years. Stryker Brigade Commander Colonel Todd Wood says his team will follow a model used successfully in Iraq to prepare Afghanistan to fend for itself.
Get off the bases, get with the security forces so that you can live and train with them, fight alongside of them 24/7. And that's the approach that's being applied right now and has been since 2009, and it's having a lot of success.
The Strykers, other U.S. units, troops from Romania, and the Afghans will comprise a force of over 18,000 working the mission. Wood says they're not going to win the war against the Taliban during the coming year, but will improve the situation in Afghanistan.
I mean, if you just look at it, just in terms of girls being able to go to school, our presence and one of these platoons' presence in a village allows that school to stay open. It allows that group and that side of the population opportunities which they would have never experienced under Taliban rule.
Commander Wood says the Army is working with U.S. government agencies to accomplish the broader socioeconomic goals. Afghanistan is more rugged and rural than Iraq, where Fort Wainwright Strikers last deployed in 2008. The combat team has seen a lot of turnover since, and many Strikers are going on their first overseas mission. Private Cody Spradlin says he's looking forward to the challenge.
I was raised by my grandfather to always do what I can to help somebody.
do what's right when I can. I'm pretty excited to be able to learn of another culture I haven't really learned anything about yet, and have a chance to help people.
Spradlin and other new soldiers will benefit from the experience of seasoned service members like Staff Sergeant David Goetz. Goetz has been on 4 previous deployments, but this is his first to Afghanistan.
The people are different. The terrain's different. The mission's kind of the same, but the progress that's made in Iraq versus, you just watch the news and say, they're winding down Iraq. Now we're going to do pretty much the same thing, or try to do the same thing in Afghanistan to get the same, hopefully the same result.
Goetz says he's been passing on advice about what works in the field and how to deal with problems. Goetz's wife, Tammy, says deployments are always tough, but this one is especially trying.
Very hard, especially when you have young children. It's different from being deployed to Iraq. Afghanistan is totally different. And so just wondering or fear of thinking that there's a great chance that he may not come back.
Strikers are heading into Afghanistan during what's called the fighting season. Commander Wood says the opening of mountain passes and the start of spring agricultural cycles ushers in more activity. He says the Fort Wainwright team's spring arrival means they will get on the ground fresh and ready for the challenge. Wood says strikers will also benefit from a new generation of mine-proof vehicles. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Strong winds blasted the southwest portion of the state yesterday and caused significant damage across the Aleutian Chain and the Alaska Peninsula. In Atka, high winds tore the door off the local clinic. And in Unalaska, cars have been hit by loose debris and a flying dumpster lid caused damage to the town's bridge. But the village of False Pass suffered the worst of the damage. According to the National Weather Service, 100-mile-an-hour winds tore off the roof of the VPSO building. A few homes also lost theirs, and residents are now being housed at the school as repairs are made. Chris Emrich is the False Pass city clerk, and he says that while he's seen high winds hit the community before, he hasn't ever seen them last this long.
The duration of the storm just lasted so long. It was a good 100, 110 for 6-8 hours.
The storm moved on to western and south central Alaska today. So far, there have been no reports of storm-related injuries in the affected communities. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, making the case for a rail link between Port McKenzie and Houston.
There's multiple mines in the interior that are not cost-effective to begin without a rail link.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
One answer to our state's declining oil production? Port McKenzie Rail Project. The link from the Alaska Railroad to a deepwater port will bring billions in mineral production and thousands of jobs. This message sponsored by the Matanuska Susitna Borough.
The pending closure of the liquefied natural gas facility in Nikiski might be getting pushed back a few months. ConocoPhillips Alaska spokesperson Natalie Lohman says that although the contract to ship gas to Tokyo Electric and Tokyo Gas ended in March, they are expecting to have some spot contracts that could last into the summer. The original closure date was expected to be April or May. Lohman says the long-term plans to mothball the LNG plant will not change because there is a lack of long-term natural gas. Agreements have not been made final, and Lohman would not say where the shipments might be going. The facility is co-owned by ConocoPhillips and Marathon Oil. The LNG plant's export license expires in March of 2013. The chairman and chief executive officer of ConocoPhillips says his company stands ready to invest substantially in Alaska to increase petroleum production if the state changes its tax structure. Jim Mulva spoke this morning at a breakfast meeting in Anchorage. Mulva embraced Governor Sean Parnell's goal of boosting pipeline throughput from 600,000 barrels per day to 1 million barrels within 10 years. Mulva says company projects already identified, such as a gas partial processing plant and a new drill pad with 50 new wells, likely will move forward if the tax is changed. Legislation is moving that could lead to a long-term extension of the state's Coastal Management Program. That's the program that coordinates permitting and plans for development projects. It's scheduled to close down July 1st unless the legislature votes before then to keep it open. APRN's Dave Donaldson reports.
A plan developed in the House Resources Committee over the weekend and passed Monday found some agreement among coastal communities who see the Coastal Management Program as essential, and developers, who have seen the agency as a roadblock. Meanwhile, the Senate Community and Regional Affairs Committee has now approved similar changes and moved their bill along toward passage. Both compromise bills establish a Coastal Policy Board to settle disputes. They eliminate the requirement to designate subsistence areas, and they make procedural changes to alleviate coastal residents' concerns with the current system. They allow one controversial element to stand, though, a section that removes the Department of Environmental Conservation from mandatory participation in the program. The Parnell administration has not yet agreed with the changes and the extension. Deputy Natural Resources Commissioner Joe Balash says the department is still reviewing them. Senate Committee Chairman Donnie Olson says he's satisfied with the compromise bill as it stands and is not aware of any further changes that need to be made. I'm Dave Donaldson in Juneau.
Senator Lisa Murkowski and Congressman Don Young have introduced new versions of their Sea Alaska land transfer bills. Murkowski's measure was filed Tuesday, and Young's was released yesterday. Both allow the Regional Native Corporation to select Tongass National Forest land. Sea Alaska could already claim acreage inside boundaries set by the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act. The new bills and their predecessors authorize selections elsewhere in Southeast Alaska. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports on how the bills have changed and what some of those involved in the debate think of them.
Sea Alaska, as a private corporation, falls under state logging rules. They include a 66-foot buffer around salmon streams, lakes, and estuaries. Murkowski spokesman Robert Dillon says the new Senate bill expands the buffer to 100 feet. That's the requirement for loggers operating on national forest lands.
It was added at the recommendation of a fisherman and environmental activist. The idea was to protect the fish in the creeks from soil erosion and higher water temperatures caused by a loss of shade trees on creek banks.
The larger buffer would be in place for 5 years. Dillon says that would allow time to review state law. Sea Alaska says it's already done that work. Vice President Rick Harris says expanded protection is not needed.
We believe that the 66-foot buffer is appropriate, but we're also very open to continuing dialogue with all interested parties to evaluate a wider buffer and to determine what the science recommends.
The Southeast Alaska Conservation Council disagrees. Forest Program Director Bob Klaus says 100 feet is needed and not just for 5 years.
It would be a lot better if it were just a blanket prescription to have the Sea Alaska lands be managed under the same regulations as federal lands under the Tongass Timber Reform Act.
Don Young's House version of the bill leaves the smaller stream buffer. Another change involves an economic development or futures site called Pegmatite Mountain. It's a potential geothermal energy plant location for Huna and other Chichagoff Island communities. But SEAC's Klaus says selection is opposed by nearby Tenakee Springs.
They're concerned that any industrial development will irrevocably change the climate and community of Tenakee Springs.
The new Senate bill still allows the land to be selected, but Murkowski staffer Dillon says it delays development for 15 years.
The delay gives them time to see if they can't come up with a small hydro project or other alternative to geothermal. But yet, if they can't, if that fails, somewhere down the road, they will still have an opportunity to revisit the geothermal project proposal.
Sea Alaska's Harris says the location is a rare chance for communities dependent on expensive diesel power.
We shouldn't be limiting the opportunities to develop renewable energy sites, but on the other hand, the time to do this kind of stuff, it takes a lot of time, so we can work within the 15-year horizon that they put in that bill.
The new Senate legislation also removes the Dog Cove Futures site near Ketchikan. Sea Alaska says it has potential for ecotourism development. Young's House version leaves the Futures sites as is. Another major difference between the bills, Young's House version includes some northwest Prince of Wales Island logging land that the Senate version dropped. Murkowski's legislation is co-sponsored by fellow Alaska Senator Mark Begich. Young's is co-sponsored by Oklahoma Democrat Dan Boren. This is Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The University of Alaska now offers both a Bachelor of Science and a Bachelor of Arts degree in fisheries. A fisheries degree prepares you for a career in fisheries biology, management, business or policy, and more. Learn more at www.uaf.edu/fish. The UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences, educating fisheries and marine science experts in Alaska for Alaska. This message sponsored by the UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences.
Alaska natives are on the move from rural villages to more urban population centers. The 2010 census confirms that. The Federal Subsistence Board met yesterday in a workshop session to begin the process of reviewing the rural status of Alaska communities based on new census information. The Alaska National Interest Lands Conservation Act mandates that only rural communities are eligible for subsistence priority on federal lands. To begin the process, the panel first heard about how 2000 census numbers shape the current status of communities. Board Chair Tim Tworek.
By congressional action, we have to review the rural, non-rural designation after every census, and that's this process. We're taking a look at how it was done in the past and how we would want to do it this year after the 2010 census.
Under current federal rural determinations, all but 10 communities in Alaska are designated as rural. But an influx of Alaska Natives from northern areas is causing concerns among some Alaska Natives in the state's southern area. South Central Regional Advisory Council Chair Ralph Losey told the board that newly relocated Alaska Natives are putting pressure on Kenai Peninsula subsistence resources and jeopardizing the community's rural status. A community larger than 7,000 is presumed non-rural under federal subsistence law, and some at the board workshop questioned that figure. Tworek says the reconsideration of rural determination criteria is in the earliest stages.
If the last census was any indication, the process started right after 2000, and I think they got the first numbers by 2003 and 2004, and the whole process of reviewing rural, non-rural issues was done by 2008. So it's going to take, you know, a number of years for us to go through the process. But we're doing the real basics right now. We're taking a look at regulations, and if there's any regulation changes that we want the Secretary of Interior or Agriculture to make, this is the opportunity for us to propose changes.
The Federal Subsistence Board is charged with administering ANILCA regulations, but it can only propose regulation changes to the legislation. Only Congress has the power to change ANILCA. The release of a final environmental impact statement at the end of March gave the nod to a rail spur linking the Matanuska-Susitna borough's Port McKenzie to the main Alaska Railroad line near Houston. As KSKA's Ellen Lockyer reports, the ultimate decision on the best route is still a month away, although borough officials say the publication of the EIS opens the way for preliminary work to start as early as this year.
The Federal Surface Transportation Board approves all new rail line construction in the country and actually makes the decision on the rail link's destination point. Three possible corridors were considered with a dozen variations that could have put the junction anywhere from Wasilla to Willow. The recent EIS finding caps a process of studies, fieldwork, and public hearings that began in 2007, and it seems Houston, population a little over 2,000 at last count, is the best point of juncture. Houston Mayor Virgie Thompson.
It's a great opportunity for Houston to get involved with the infrastructure in the valley, and hopefully it's going to create some jobs locally, also some industry for the area.
The rail link will connect Point McKenzie to the state's main rail transportation line at an estimated cost of $218 million. It is the largest infrastructure project backed by the Matanuska-Susitna borough since the construction of the park's highway, according to Patty Sullivan, borough spokesperson.
It means 3,000 construction-related jobs. It will mean 4,000 indirect and direct jobs related to mining.
Sullivan says the preferred railroad alignment is expected to reduce the link's impact on the area it traverses.
It runs from Port McKenzie up through the agricultural district to Houston South is the alignment. And there's only one small house that could be relocated or purchased. No other homes were affected. Several wetlands had to be avoided. There's lots of mitigations along the route.
The state is supporting the rail project. There's $20 million in the capital budget for it, and the borough is asking for $35 million more from this legislature for preliminary work on the project to start next summer.
It's a statewide project. It is estimated that it'll bring $300 million a year annually in taxes, royalties, and fees to the state of Alaska. There's multiple mines in the interior that are not cost-effective to begin without a rail link. You can't get anything going unless you've got cheap transportation costs. And this link from the interior to Tidewater is a shorter link, and it's efficient.
If the final EIS is approved after a 30-day waiting period to comply with the National Environmental Policy Act, the board is expected to finalize the Houston decision. The borough will then get to work on advertising for a construction contract for the first 5 miles of rail embankment. How will all this affect the little community of Houston on the Little Susitna River? Houston was first noted on a 1917 Alaska Railroad map as Houston Siding. The town, once important as a coal transportation site, has mainly been a quiet recreational destination since the coal business dried up after World War II. Mayor Thompson says there's plenty of room there for warehouses and plenty of gravel sources available locally. She says she is hearing some grumbling from those who are not welcoming growth.
The last comprehensive plan that was put together was in 2003, and we're currently trying to work on that now. And, you know, basically, the residents helped with that plan, and they just wanted controlled future growth.
A Port McKenzie Rail Extension Project open house is set for April 7th at Evangelo's Restaurant in Wasilla, starting at 7 p.m. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Alexandra Gutierrez in Unalaska, Jacob Resnick in Kodiak, Ben Stanton in Kenai, Dan Brass in Fairbanks, Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, and Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., and Dave Donaldson from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking rope, chain, and boat anchors from 5 to 3,000 pounds on the web at arcticwirerope.com. GrantStation, your fast track to funding on the web at grantstation.com, serving Alaskan organizations for over 10 years. And by the Alaska Budget Report, providing in-depth coverage for state government since 1991, on the web at akbudgetreport.com.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.